talking about the same study that David was talking about, Minnesota machining study. And this study is basically done. We're now in the data analysis and publication phase. I'm going back to the very beginning of the design of this study, talk a little bit about how one puts together an intervention study. When we first, you may be familiar with the fact that we did another study several years ago in woodworking, and we used the pre-seed-proceed model for planning the study and designing it. But we found that that model was lacking in details about how one selects and designs interventions, the intervention activities themselves. And for this study, we looked around a little bit to find a better model for intervention mapping. And this actually is called an intervention mapping model. It's Dr. Bartholomew is the first to use it and propose it and call it that. There are others who've published models that are similar. So it's both a study planning model, but also an intervention design model. And I like it because it forces you to go to the end, just as all of these models do, and think about what you hope to have at the end, and then step backwards in terms of all the things that lead to those outcomes. It allows you to integrate whatever behavioral theories you think are appropriate. So it causes you to go and look for those theories and think about them, as well as any epidemiologic evidence and any information you know about your target population. So as David mentioned, we had an advisory board, people from various government agencies, from the businesses themselves, owners, and a union representative, one or two business associations, some technical schools, some professionals. And we asked them to help us, you know, pull together information about the industry. And we also, of course, pulled together information about what do we know about machine safety. There are both OSHA regulations and there are ANSI consensus standards. The latter are probably the better of the two because they're more up to date. We also had a number of health and safety professionals, some with very specific expertise. And if any of you have ever worked on machine guarding, this is probably one of the more complicated health and safety issues there are. These machines are extremely complex, especially as you get into power presses. So it was important to understand how they work. We did do some focus groups with employees to try and understand their perspectives and what working with machines was like in small businesses. And we did some pilot testing at various small metal fabrication businesses. So all of that was the data gathering phase. And basically, that you need that in order to start designing a study. And one thing we've learned from these studies is you need at least a year and preferably 2 years to do a really good design and planning for an intervention study, especially one with 40 shops and a lot of intervention activities. So, but this basically outlines the intervention mapping process where you define what your objectives are, you pick your methods and strategies, come up with a plan for how you'll implement those, your interventions, and then you also have to identify how you'll adopt and implement all of the interventions and then monitor and evaluate your success. I'm not going to talk much about the latter two steps, but more about the first. So to define your program objectives, you have to think about what changes are you really looking for in either behaviors, you know, people's behavior, and that would be both owners and workers in this case, or environmental conditions. And for each of those objectives, look at what are the determinants that underlie them. So what leads to the situation as it currently stands, and what behavioral theories seem relevant to that. And then identify very specific learning or change objectives. So let me give some examples for our study. in terms of our goal, it was to bring about improvements in machine and, as David mentioned, workplace safety. As I just mentioned, we were interested in both owners and employees, and in fact, it was not necessarily a controlled group, as two interventions that we were comparing, one solely aimed at business owners and one at owners plus employees. So what we knew about owners is that there is a failure to provide safe machinery and a safe environment, not overall or not in every business and at different levels in businesses, but there does, as David mentioned, there does seem to be a lack of good safety with respect to machinery. They are lacking in knowledge and resources and time, and that's been clearly demonstrated in the literature. One thing in small businesses is that their equipment is relatively old. It's often passed on from one business to the next. As they get a new piece of equipment, they sell off their old ones. they're really not willing to contact OSHA, as David mentioned, and so won't see them unless there's been a serious injury. The regulations and standards are extremely complex, even the more up-to-date ones. Of course, nobody on site has health and safety expertise in most cases, and so really, unless they work closely with their workers' comp insurance or with their business association, generally they really don't have much external assistance. And in both those cases, they have to make an effort to obtain that external assistance. And so it's really hard. They actually don't have many tools to evaluate the safety of their shops and their machines. So what we wanted was, these were the specific stated goals, that they should be able to do all of these specific things at the end of our intervention. And this is basically setting the goals for the study. I'm not going to read all of these for you, but it's basically building knowledge and building skills in terms of machine guarding and business safety. What we do know about employees, and this is somewhat converse to what most people believe about employees, is that they actually will follow safe procedures and will use guards in most cases if they're available, if they're trained, if they're not shortcutted by other policies, in other words, required to work on piece rates, and if people around them, both their supervisors and their peers, expect and support that they behave that way. So we go in with that expectation. And these were our goals for employees. What we hoped is that they would see machine safety in a more positive manner, that they would be able to use if the guards were there, they would use them, and that they would actually become more involved as well, more empowered, so to speak, in participating in decision making. David already mentioned these, so I'm not going to go into great detail, but these are we basically focused on social cognitive theory and these four constructs: self-efficacy, reinforcements, environment, and situation. And so for every determinant and every performance objective, you have to come up with a specific goal. And so for every one of the constructs and every one of those goals we set, and for each target population, we had to set a goal about what they should be doing. I'll give an example. If business owners should be able to assess job safety, then what we want is to be sure that in the environment there is accessible and useful information, that we've given them a chance to use that information more confidently, so we've given them some hands-on opportunities, that they see satisfaction or improvements in satisfaction from employees so get some reinforcement, and that they begin to see that shop safety is important to their business. So I'm just listing a range of things one might select, and we did try to use a number of these in our intervention design. And so then basically what you're doing is using all that information to move towards developing an intervention, so focusing on all of those outcomes and objectives and the methods you've identified. So in terms of business owners, with these sort of overarching goals, we developed a written report that our advisory board reviewed and owners reviewed in our pilot study, which was very colorful and very graphical, and the idea was to try and both compare themselves to themselves as well as to all the other people participating in the study, and really picking out the key things that they should be focusing on, our high priority items. Plus, we gave them lots of resources and on a CD that was accessible. It was easy to use. And with the owners, now that was just owners only. So in owners and employees, we did both the things we did with owners, as well as we focused on health and safety committees. As David mentioned, that seemed to be a really key point or a key place at which you could start to make a difference in business safety and machine safety, and had a peer trainer, someone who's a machinist with some expertise in health and safety, who worked with the Health and Safety Committee members in building knowledge and then skills in using checklists and evaluating their business, their safety, their machines, and thinking about what they can do next to make improvements. So to summarize, I could go into a lot more detail, but just to give you sort of an overview of the things we did, what I found was that intervention mapping gave me a much clearer idea of all this, and it has a very nice delineated set of steps by which one makes decisions about the target populations, the constructs or behavioral theories, and the techniques one will use, and the specific outcomes one expects by making you think very systematically. And it does, in the end, lead to a very nice set of measurable objectives because you've delineated each of those objectives. And you can use surveys and observations and other ways to assess your success. Thank you.
Are there questions for Lisa? Yeah. Yes.
Well, I have to tell you that David Parker, sitting here in the front, is by par excellence a recruiter of small businesses. I suggest you talk to him. But once they were recruited into the study, one of the key things about being recruited is they had to agree up front they would participate in all the intervention activities. So that was a requirement of eligibility and recruitment into a study. If they weren't willing to do that, there really didn't seem to be a reason to have them participate. We had 40, is that right? Right, 40 businesses, yeah. Leslie, yeah. No, we did get an OSHA agreement, Minnesota OSHA agreement, that they would not inspect anybody who was in the study during the time they were in the study. That didn't seem to be much of incentive, however. And no one was interested in that. Yes, Beth. Oh, sure. Yeah. I think it's persistence, and you know, it's being very polite and very respectful, but persistence. You really just need to keep at these folks and keep calling. And yep. Yeah. If we could can it, we would. Do we have time for one more? Okay, there was one more. Well, and that does take some persistence as well. We did have lost a follow-up of, I think, one shop. Okay. He is, so you guys can hire him to get, yeah.
Thanks, Lisa. Okay, moving right along. Now we're going to hear about hotel workers. And
yeah.
What's your first name? Pamela.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for being here, and I'm Pamela Vasanis. I'm the health and safety rep from Unite Here for the hotel division at the International Union. I'm going to introduce Kim Murray, who's a hotel housekeeper from the Capitol Hill Hyatt here in D.C. and a member of Local 25. And she's going to tell us about the contract gains in their recent contract of October 1st. And then we're going to talk a little bit about things that housekeepers have done in the past 3 years between the last contract and this one as part of build-up for this contract to improve the workload for hotel housekeepers. Also on the back table, there's some related publications you might find of interest on your way out. Thank you.
Okay, I'm a little nervous though. I'm Kimberly Murray. I work at the Hyatt Regency on Capitol Hill. I worked there for 12 years, and I'm also one of the shop leaders there. Basically, the rooms that we do, it's like, let's see, how would I put this? It's not easy. Let's put it that way. Depending on what floor you're on, it depends on how many rooms you will have. You have 15 to 14 rooms a day, and depending on what group that's in-house, some ladies will have, like, 30 rooms, like not 30, I'm going to say 30 beds, actually, because there's two beds in each room. So in our contract this year, our main goal was for the housekeeper to have quota relief, which will allow management to actually drop rooms before you have to do it yourself and get in trouble for it. So actually, the relief would be if you have 7 rooms that's been used as double, they would drop one to two rooms. I think it's, yeah, 1 room. And if you have 10, it will drop another room. But if you have, even though if you have doubles or not, if you end up with 15 checkouts, they would automatically drop up to like 3 rooms. And that would alleviate some of the pressure from rushing around doing rooms, falling and tripping over things. When you're making a bed, you have sheets that's like larger than the bed itself. So you have like extended over and you can trip. It's easy actually to trip over sheets. You wouldn't believe it. The lifting of the mattress itself, it will cause a lot of ladies to have like lower back pain, so that will help them also do less rooms. A lot of ladies actually been hurting their wrists because of the weight of the mattress, and it's actually down into a box frame, so you have to dig down, lift up. So that, by having quota relief, will help that out also. Let's see. We fought for light duty because a lot of businesses won't allow you to have light duty when you hurt yourself at work. They would rather for you to stay home, you know, do workman's comp and so forth, disability. But now since we fought for that, they have to at least provide some light duty. They will have to make an effort to provide the light duty. If they don't have it, at least they have to show proof that right now we don't have light duty for you, and they have to show proof that they don't have it. And if they do have it, they give it to you. Depending on how many ladies, because sometimes we end up with 4 or 5 ladies on light duty at one time, and then they have to provide for some, or even if it's just one, then they have to show proof why they can provide for everybody at the same time. Which is kind of funny because it's you can't really weigh the difference on whose severity of health is more than the other. So they have to say, well, this person has more seniority, which is kind of really something that we're really still working on for the next contract. Let's see what else. Yeah. As far as some of the hotels I know particularly my hotel, the Hyatt Regency, they started this impact training, which is across the board through all the Hyatts, where they're trying to find different tools to work with. You know, some people will actually get on their hands and knees and clean the floor. Mops are fine, but it leaves too much debris and dirt as far as like hair, and we can't really see it. So they're using the Swiffit, you know, the things that you actually see on commercials. They're using that after you clean the floor, you have to reuse that to clean it. And then far as like, I'm gonna step out a minute. I hope you all can hear me. Clean it, change the sponge on it so it can dry, because they actually, we don't really like to leave any water behind because you want things to shine. So you have to change that, dry it, and, you know, completely dry it off. It's a lot of tools that they're saying they're trying to get, which we haven't seen only but one item so far, but they're at least trying to make an effort of getting it. We're going to still fight for that also. Okay, the standard room takes about a half an hour to do. With 8 hours in a day and 14 to 15 rooms, it's actually supposed to be a half an hour for each room. Sometimes a little less, and sometimes it can take like 45 minutes to an hour, depending on who left the room and how they left it and what condition they left it in. For some of us ladies that do larger suites, it goes by credit. So if you have a suite, it would actually consist of four rooms. So that means instead of you having 14 rooms, you have probably 10 rooms on your sheet, because that one room is four rooms, and it can take sometimes 2 to 3 hours to do, just like I say, depending on who left the room. And sometimes you have business people, which is a lot better because, of course, they don't leave the rooms as messy. But if you have a large family or a group like the educational tour group, which is a lot of children, and they try not to actually put them on the higher floors with the business people because, you know, you don't want to hear the noise. So they try to keep them on the lower floors where it's actually two beds per room. And I've seen those rooms, which I don't get because I'm on a higher floor. It's terrible. And it's hard on a lot of the ladies because they use a lot of candy and, you know, paper and, you know, all this junk food and everything. And everything is, like, basically on the floor. So you're, like, all day long down, down. So now they're coming up with this tool, which we've seen out on the street, that you pick up. And so you won't have to do so much bending because, you know, after doing it, I mean, I really don't care how young you are. After doing labor work like that, it puts a wear and tear on your body. So, because I'm only 36, and sometimes when I get home, I'm like, oh, my God, my body is tired. It's hurting. So that quota relief helps out a lot, and that was a big fight on that because I hate to say this, but it helps us. But far as business-wise, they're saying it's hurting them because by them dropping so many rooms, they don't have anybody to pick it up until, like, the next day, so it sits and waits. But that happens.
That's it for as far as the Hyatt, yeah.
Okay. I'm just going to give some examples about what hotel workers in Local 25 have done in the past 3 years since their last contract, because they got some landmark language that said that if the work, if due to, like, renovation or changes in the hotel, there's a significant change in workload, then the hotel needs to consult with the union about workload. And as any of you know who have been staying in hotels, you know, they've all gotten fluffier and thicker and plusher and pillows everywhere. And so there are a significant change in the workload. And so Local 25 has been very active in the past 3 years and getting things like fitted sheets instead of triple sheets, because on average we've seen it takes about 8 lifts to make a bed. That's, you know, 100-pound lift times 8, 2 beds in a room, like 15 feet in the math. Workers also have been fighting these duvets. Some of them were, you know, they weigh anything from 9 to 15 pounds. And at the Embassy Row Hilton, we had a grievance over the duvets and whole bedding package. And the workers actually brought in a 15-pound bowling ball because the duvet weighed 15 pounds and asked the GM to lift it over his head, you know, like 30 times, because that's what they do every time when they have to shake out the duvet. He would not lift the 15-pound bowling ball, nor would he show up at mediation. And so we won that mediation. We got rid of the 15-pound duvet. It got reduced to, it's more like a scarf, more like a decoration now on the bed. And we also, we got finishes at a number of places, and in, I think, the Marriott Boardman Park,
they minimized the carts now for our hotel, because the older carts were like a heavy metal with wood on top. So now it's a lighter metal, it's no wood, and it's been a little, it's been, I can say about 6-7 inches shorter. And then now they have a standard of how many items you can actually keep on your cart. Because some ladies will overstock their cart and it will actually make it a little heavier. And then they changed the, when they re-renovated, they actually changed the padding on the floor that's underneath the carpet to make it a little thinner. You can still feel the cushion of it, but it's not as hard for us to push.
Part of the overstocking is part of that time factor.
Yeah.
If you have too many rooms, you're not going to be making trips back and forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some of them, some hotels do that. Ours in particular, we pack our own carts in the morning, but our houseman does assist us and bring whatever you need to you. They can bring it to you. I mean, we'll neatly put it on the cart. They just hand it to you, so you won't have to do that trip back and forth.
But there's still a lot of work we need to do.
What would the task be? Okay, it depends on your, you know, when you go to the doctor, they fill out this form and they will say if you're able to, how many hours you can stand and sit and how many pounds that you can pick up and so forth, and how far you can reach depending on the situation, depending on the case. So actually they would have some ladies like clean the lobby area, which is like some dusting and the bathrooms and changing the toilet paper. If we're putting leaflets in the rooms or changing out any compendiums as far as like room service information, they would give them that to do. It's small things they would give them to do. It wouldn't be too much lifting and bending. Anything that's not on their sheet, they wouldn't give them to do.
But in some other hotels, in other cities, we've had a problem where the light duties actually work in some cases in the house.
Mm.
Like having them, you know, empty trash barrels in the parking lot.
Mm. You mean far as like dropping rooms because we've tried that when we first had our renovation in 98 when they changed the furniture and changed the items in the room, we fought for that and it was a hard fight and we didn't win it. So, I mean, we still got stuck with the 14 and 15 rooms. And it took years actually just to get this room quota relief. And that's only due to the fact of the checkouts and how many people is in the room and things like that. But far as like manipulating furniture and things like that, no, we haven't gotten it for that.
Huge.
Okay. Well, I know for some of the hotels like ours, we have 30-year employees, 31-year employees, and actually have had the same section for about at least, I'd say 25 to 26 of those years. Some of those ladies have their sections for the exact 30 years. Like myself, I had my one particular section for 11 years. And on my days off, somebody will have that section for those 2 days. That one lady will have my section for those 2 days. Then I will come back to my section. If a person is off for, like, on sick leave, one particular person would do that section. If that person is off those 2 days, somebody else will pick up for those 2 days. That one person will have it for those 2 days. So if you can try to see and monitor the housekeeper that's doing your room and you've seen that person throughout your stay, talk to them. I mean, we'll talk back. I mean, because I had a lot of guests that would talk, and they would ask you, you know, what day you off? I'm leaving on so-and-so day, and I want to leave you something. And I would say, well, I'm off this and that day. And they said, well, I'm leaving in the morning. And they'd give it to you right then instead of waiting. You saw three? Well, it depends on the hotel, because we try to keep a system. And it depends on the shop leader, actually, for the union hotels, to make sure that system stays in place on how they schedule the ladies for each floor. So I don't know about the non-union places and how they do their, you know, their
the
room situation.
Too, we've been told is, you know, you get the stationery, if you look around in the folder, that you could put it, you know, in the envelope and write, you know, this amount, you know, X number of dollars is for, you know, the housekeeper. Mm-hmm. And you could sign your name, you know, and at least, you know, if they get questioned, they could show that, and then they could, like, match your name up.
That's funny, because our hotel took ours out. So we don't have the stationery or the envelope. So actually, we, you know, talk to the guests. Well, you can do that also. Mm-hmm. Yeah. When you leave it on a desk near your other items, most people won't touch it because, you know, they're not sure. Yeah, even a bathroom. Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.